where we left off last time, I just wanted to remind everybody of the symmetries that we discussed of the Lagrangian for two flavors of quarks. Those are up on the top board, but I went through it yesterday. So there is the left-handed SU2, right-handed SU2, and those can alternatively be grouped as the vector plus the axial, where vector is just left plus right, acting in the same direction, and the axial is left and right acting in opposite directions. And then there's a U1 vector. Now, we ended last lecture, and I apologize, my discussion was a little confusing. We ended with a discussion of the fourth apparent symmetry, the axial U1. So just adding a gamma 5, if you will, in the Dirac notation to the expression for JV. At a classical level, you look at the Lagrangian, it looks like a symmetry. But the point is, you have to check anytime you're dealing with a quantum theory, you have to make sure that quantum mechanically, it really is a symmetry of the path integral, if you will, or a symmetry of the consistent with all the quantum corrections, regardless of how you define them. So in particular, you have to check, to have any right to call some transformation a symmetry, it must be that del mu j mu, where j mu is the current for that symmetry, has to vanish. If it doesn't vanish, it's not a symmetry. So you have to check that. In principle, you would think you have to check that to all orders in perturbation theory. Now, fortunately, it turns out that it's been shown that actually all of these, all the possible quantum inconsistencies show up at one loop. In fact, in four dimensions, they show up specifically at one loop in these triple products of currents, where you have three potentially different currents, take a matrix element of them, that'll show a non-zero answer any time del mu j mu isn't equal to zero because of these quantum effects called anomalies. So in this case, if you calculate this diagram, among other things, you will find that del mu j mu actually isn't zero, that this expectation value behaves as though del mu j mu for the axial current was actually proportional to alpha s times some field strength contracted with an epsilon tensor for the strong interactions. Okay, and there's a smaller contribution. If you add in electromagnetic interactions, there's a smaller contribution from them too. The main point, though, is this expression here, it is not equal to zero. It doesn't vanish. And so U1A, this thing that looked like a symmetry at the classical level, is not conserved. And in fact, since alpha s is getting strong in the low energy limit, as QCD becomes strong, we expect it to be not conserved very badly. So it's not even a good approximate symmetry of the theory. It is really broken severely by quantum mechanical effects. Okay. So now having, I hope that clears up a little bit the logic of the last discussion of anomalies yesterday. We're left with this SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry breaking structure. And this is going to be a very nihilistic lecture because the symmetry that we built up last time, we're going to cut it down. We're going to break it down and see what's left. But the spirit of the symmetry will survive. So I just want to start with a simple example, which will prove very relevant to us, which is just adding a quark mass term. So this is going to look like, I'm going to add a term to the Lagrangian that is Q right conjugate transpose, so that I can contract it with my UD column vector over here, times some M, which is a matrix in this quark space, times Q left. Okay, so this is a Lorentz scalar. I'm contracting two left-handed spinners together. It is it's invariant under, it's just a singlet under this global SU2. What does this do to the symmetries of the theory? It no longer respects all the symmetries, right? Does it respect the U1 vector? So let's say I rephase Q left. U in vector says I rephase Q left. I rephase Q right conjugate by the opposite phase because the if you look in the current, it has a minus sign there. And so this would go to, under U1 vector, it would go to Q right conjugate transpose e to the minus I phi m e to the plus I phi Q left, which obviously these phases just commute through the matrix. That's obviously just equal to the original. So U1 vector is respected by the mass term. What about U1 axial? Sorry, never mind U1 axial. We won't talk. What about SU2 axial? Yeah. Right. So we can take SU2 axial. Act on this matrix, and it's going to take this guy to some e to the I alpha a tau a, where the transpose is undone because I'm acting on the transposed vector, times m times e to the I alpha a tau a Q left. So if I call this matrix V, this is now equal to Q right conjugate transpose times VM V Q left. And in general, for any unitary matrix V, this is not the same thing as just having M there. These are different matrices. So SU2A is broken by a mass term. Now, how about SU2 vector? Yeah. We could. This is still V. So then let's say this was the identity, proportional to the identity. I can just pull it out and we'd have V squared. Okay, but you just answered my next question. Because SU2 vector, the sign of the tau is flipped on the action on Q right relative to the SU2 axial. So it goes to V dagger MV. Let's say we've chosen to start to work in a basis where M equals M up, M down, then SU2 vector is broken not by a general mass matrix, but by M up minus M down. Because clearly if this mass matrix were diagonal, V is a unitary matrix, sorry. I should complete the expression though. Then that would just be M times V dagger V, and that would just be equal to M. So mass terms, in the presence of mass terms, U1 vector is exact, exactly conserved. In the presence of mass. Exactly conserved. SU2 vector is broken by M up minus M down. And SU2 axial is just broken by any mass matrix. Yeah. Are you wondering whether I should, I need to add the Hermitian conjugate of this, or the complex conjugate of that. Thank you. So, and of course, since it's just the conjugate of this, the symmetry transformation is exactly the same, but I do need to write the conjugate term. Okay, let's talk briefly about electromagnetic interactions. Let's assign the up and down quarks their usual charges. Up has charge 2/3 and down has charge 1/3, minus 1/3. So what do electromagnetic interactions do? Or let me ask, which of these symmetries might they preserve? So what am I doing when I add electromagnetic interactions? I am basically adding terms of the form Q left bar I, and then I'm adding to my del mu plus I G3 A mu lambda A over 2. That's my strong piece. And now I'm adding an electromagnetic piece. It's IE, call it B mu. There's no flavor matrix. This is just electromagnetism. It's just a U1. But there is now some, I can write it as a charge matrix in the Q left, Q right space. Q, and that's it, Q left. And this Q matrix, the up quark has charge 2/3, and the down quark has charge minus 1/3. And then there's a similar term for the Q rights. Similar term for Q right. But just looking at the Q left term, with this charge Q in there, what does that do to the symmetries again? So this is actually very similar to the case of M up not equal to M down right here, except that instead of having a Q left, a Q right on one side and a Q left on the other side, we have just a Q left bar and a Q left. Okay, but so we'll always have things of the, so under the U1, these take opposite phases, and those phases go right through the Q term, and that's, so that's respected. So again, exactly conserved. Under the SU2s, it doesn't matter whether it's vector or axial, this term is just looking at the action on Q left, they act the same way on Q left. In all cases, this Q will go to something that looks like a V dagger Q V. And I just told you that the charges are different. So that means that the electromagnetic interactions break both of these symmetries. Okay. This will be important to us later in the lecture. Now, I'm not going to add generic mass terms right now. I'll keep that till the end. But let's just go back to this quark model picture of what the QCD phase transition is doing. So in this picture, we think of QCD as it gets strong, effectively giving each quark some mass. And it doesn't care whether it's an up quark or a down quark. So the QCD phase transition, strong QCD, can be thought of as giving the up and down equal masses at low energies. So that would suggest that the QCD phase transition and I'm going to make that a squiggly imply because this is just a word argument. QCD phase transition is going to break the SU2 axial spontaneously. Now, let's try to make that argument a little more precise. It's still going to be, you know, an argument, not a proof, but let's try to describe that dynamics in a somewhat more careful way. So here's the sort of dynamical picture of what's happening in that phase transition. Yeah. So, okay, that is a good question. In QCD, we know that as a function of so you've probably at least heard this mentioned. If not, I should definitely mention it now. As a function of the renormalization scale mu, there's a beta function for the coupling G3. And this beta function actually, so the beta functions, in general, you can solve them at one loop so that 1 over alpha 3 has linear dependence on log mu, or mu is the renormalization scale. That's the, okay, that's just a convenient way of writing it, but let me actually just talk about the running of G3. At high scales, G3 is relatively weak. It runs slowly, but it runs up. And so at some point, at least at one loop, G3 just hits an exponential pull at low energies. Okay, so at some point, it's going to hit 4 pi. This happens in the neighborhood of a few hundred MeV. So this theory is becoming strongly coupled, which means that you don't expect, you expect something dramatic has to happen here. And at around that scale, to the degrees of freedom. In particular, above that energy scale, we have a theory of interacting quarks that scatter through QCD. Yeah, Trevor? Very roughly, at 4 pi, when the coupling is 4 pi, the reason I'm saying 4 pi rather than 1 is strong coupling. And this is all a bit heuristic, whether it's 4 pi or 2 pi or, you know, 3.6 pi. But the very rough issue is that if you look at, say, at quark-quark scattering through one gluon or through a whole bunch of two gluons or through three gluons, and there really should be some dependence on NC in where I set this number. That's another reason it's vague. As I look at all of these diagrams, this one is usually suppressed by an extra factor of alpha over 4 pi. This one's suppressed by alpha squared over 16 pi squared, again, very roughly. So when alpha hits 4 pi, your perturbation-ish, again, there's numbers in front of each of these, so this is not an exact argument by any means. When alpha hits 4 pi is when every loop is the same size as the other loops. And so you've completely lost perturbation theory. Alpha, this is alpha 3, just the G3 squared over 4 pi. So you may ask, where is the extra, you know, where is this 4 pi coming from, which really in terms of couplings is a 16 pi squared, and it's coming from doing that extra loop integral, which had a d4p over 2 pi to the fourth associated with each loop that you add. And then there's usually something of order pi squared in the numerator that you get just from the basically, I mean, you can think of it roughly as the volume of a three sphere is 2 pi squared. And so you end up canceling all but roughly a 16 pi squared out of this with numerator factors that are of order pi squared. Like what? Yeah. So I mean, I could have written different diagrams. Okay. I mean, I can I can draw these diagrams if you're happier with it. You know, there's plenty of diagrams that grow, and I was just trying to give the rough argument for the 4π. So, which anyway is a rough number. So the whole I don't want to get too sidetracked by the 4π thing. But the key question that I want to ask is really, once QCD gets strong, what, if anything, do we know about the low energy degrees of freedom of the theory? Okay, are there any low energy degrees of freedom? The fact that there's, I mean, for example, we know that some of the states that come, that we see at low energies coming out of this, are states like the proton, the neutron, the delta. All their masses, you know, are of order 1 GeV. You might ask, is there any reason for there to be states that are parametrically lighter than 1 GeV? You know, why, given this spectrum, it actually seems a little bit surprising at first glance that we observe pions with a mass of 100 or so, 135 to 140 MeV. And kaons at around half of that, 500. And there's a special structure among these. So that's what I want to try to explain. And we're going to start from a limit where we neglect quark masses and we won't get these numbers. We'll only get these numbers, well, we'll only get an understanding of these numbers once we add in the quark masses. But the first step is really to understand what, if anything, we can say about the low energy degrees of freedom of a theory with this kind of phase transition, with this kind of strong coupling going on in QCD. So we know that the QCD coupling gets strong, and we know just empirically that at very low energies, we don't see gluons traveling around. So those degrees of freedom aren't the right ones at low energies, yeah. Few hundred MeV. And I mean, defining. Well, in a sense, we do see evidence of quarks and gluons at the LHC. We do see evidence that at 1 TeV or even, you know, 50 GeV in the hard collision, it looked like a quark and gluon transition. But what matters is the, you know, for this, for the question of what degrees of freedom do you as an observer see, is really the sort of, is really the physics at the length scale that you're actually, right, at what you're actually observing. So we are not in a, in a frame that where we see these, well, we end up seeing much lower energy particles. We actually end up seeing they're glancing interactions with matter. I mean, relative to this 500 GeV, this 50 or 100 GeV scale, they are glancing interactions at around the GeV scale that we see. And so the degrees of freedom that we observe on length scales, in other words, another way of saying it is that our detectors are much bigger than an inverse GeV. They're much bigger than a nucleus. Okay, that's sort of obvious. We don't know how to build detectors smaller than a nucleus. As long as we're building detectors whose scale of measurement is bigger than a nucleus, what we will see with those detectors are the low energy states, and the long distance degrees of freedom. But we do see hints of this perturbative QCD behavior at higher energies. I don't know if I'll have much time to talk about that later in the class, but I hope I get to it. So let me leave it for then. Okay, so I want to go back to this question of what's happening to the quarks as QCD gets strongly coupled. And I'm going to take a detour that I hope I'll connect back to this in a second, in a clear way. I just want you to consider states that have a quark. Sorry, I have trouble drawing these arrows, right? A quark, say a U left, and a U right conjugate, traveling with, so their spins cancel each other. Spins cancel each other. This is a Lorentz invariant state of a spin zero state of two quarks. I can also add analogous diagrams for the down quarks. Okay, so I'm just describing a state of two quarks right now. And then I can also add terms for the bar, the Q bars. Both the right-handed antiquarks and the left-handed quarks, which are represented by bars in this notation. So this is a state, this is an excitation. It has spin zero. It also has isospin zero, by which I mean it's neutral under the SU2 vector. But it breaks this chiral isospin, the one that treats the U left and the U right different conjugate as rotating the same way, right? If I do an SU2 transformation of V on this U left, it does the same transformation on the U right conjugate, and now I've just transformed that state. So from that, we can also think about states with a condensate. of these pairs. So what do I mean by that? I mean pairs, states where we can think of some of classically deforming the expectation value of this operator of the U left, U right conjugate of X plus the other terms. Not going to be equal to zero. So just adding in a bunch of these quarks. Now, why do I mention that? Well, as we think about the, if we think about these states, it's a Lorentz invariant thing that I'm doing. So these are still Lorentz invariant states. They're candidate vacua. And as long as I'm adding these with appropriately at all energies to make that a Lorentz invariant state. This vacuum, this new candidate vacuum psi with these excitations, it's going to have a different vacuum energy. Because in vacuum, I can source various QCD diagrams. Right? There's now a classical expectation value in this state for these operators. So if I write down diagrams, yeah. Sure. So, let's see. Can you guys actually see that, or is it too low on the board? I'll move it up. Yeah. That's just typographical error. So this kind of diagram will mean that the energy, the expectation, that the energy expectation value in these states is not equal. It's going to change. It's not equal to your free vacuum expectation, which we usually just define to be zero. Well, that's conventional labeling. So we don't know the signs of these changes, okay? But at strong coupling, it's certainly possible. Like I said, this is only a dynamical picture with a plausibility argument, not a proof. It's plausible that at strong enough coupling, the effects of all these diagrams will be able to actually create a, will actually be able to lower the energy. Then if they do that, if these kinds of effects lower the energy, then your normal, you know, your free vacuum, right, or your perturbative vacuum of QCD, the one with no expectation values for these operators, isn't the real lowest energy state in the system. So if these expectation values through this kind of diagram can actually lower the energy, then you know that the true vacuum has these sort of quark bilinears in it. Okay, so you can think of it as being filled with this sort of quark bilinear field. Now, and then that's the state we should expand around. But that vacuum that I was just talking about, it breaks the chiral isospin. So that's another kind of dynamical picture you can have in your mind for why strong QCD at strong coupling could break this chiral isospin symmetry. Ultimately, we know this mostly through direct observation, that we know that if QCD is a good description of nature, which it seems to be in many domains, then this needs to be true in order to get a consistent theory of these low energy particles, the pions, the kaons, and so on. And so that gives us, that's our real evidence that the that QCD actually does at strong coupling break this chiral isospin. Not some arguments about bilinears. Yeah.
So if we consider the whole model and we have a QCD factor here,
yeah,
we have a different vacuum for the electroweak state. What's the vacuum state from the whole standard model?
It has it in terms of like the spontaneous symmetry breaking of the weak sector? Well, we have both the, all the evidence today suggests that we have both something that we should think of as a quark bilinear expectation value, which is small around the QCD, set by the QCD scale, and a Higgs expectation value, which in terms of the overall field, it produces is much bigger. So there's nothing wrong with having two expectation values. And even with the weak interactions, this isospin is a very good approximate symmetry of the theory at scales of around a GeV.
So if you have two beds,
yeah,
if you were to write, say, the vacuum state in terms of some excited states, or excitations of this kind of sort, how would that look? To expand the vacuum in terms of physical degrees of freedom.
I'm not going to answer that off the top of my head because I'd probably get it wrong. But I mean, essentially, you're just building a coherent state. Morally, you're building a coherent state of Higgs field and a coherent state of this and superimposing them on each other. But there's never any need to think of it that way because below the W and Z mass scales, you're, you know, even at the W and Z mass scales, you're perfectly within your rights to just work in an effective theory about the vacuum where the Higgs has a VeV, the quarks have masses, and you just ask what happens to these low energy degrees of freedom. So you never really need to know about, I mean, who knows how many other symmetries are broken at scales above our heads? We don't care. They don't affect any of the calculations we do. Yeah?
Is adding a fermion in condensate the only way to break the axially suspended symmetry?
This is pretty much the only thing we can write down in terms of the quark fields that is Lorentz invariant and SU2 invariant. So, yeah.
When you say chiral isospin, you mean both the SU2 axial and SU2 vector?
No, I mean the SU2 axial.
But isn't the SU2 axial already broken at the Lagrangian level?
So I want to imagine a theory, go back to the theory I wrote on the board, where the quarks don't have mass, and so it's not broken at the Lagrangian level. And once we've done that, we'll incorporate the quark masses back into this picture, but the approximate symmetry breaking will still be significant. So let's say I have a vacuum now, my true vacuum, which has, pardon my change of notation here, but I'm going to label my perturbative vacuum just by a zero so that I can use omega to refer to a true vacuum after this SU2 axial breaks. So let's say that our true vacuum, for example, is one such that the U left, U right conjugate expectation value is equal to the D left, D right conjugate expectation value. And that's equal to minus delta. So in other words, we can write, and the cross terms, which would break, the U, UD are absent. So in other words, in terms of my Q fields, this is equal to a delta. I'll give this guy an I index and this a J index. These I's and J's just are 1 and 2. It's just a delta IJ times minus delta IJ times delta. Now, we don't know what this delta is because we don't know at all what value of these bilinear expectation values would actually minimize the potential for QCD at strong coupling. That's something we can get a handle on a lattice, but we can't get a handle on it from, perturbative thinking. So under these chiral isospin transformations, it's a broken symmetry, but I can still ask, what does that transformation do? It of course transforms these fields. So for example, this term would go, let me work with this IJ form. The Q right I, conjugate I, would go to Q right conjugate times some unitary matrix U. And Q left will go to Q left times the same unitary matrix U, but if I want to write it as, I want to do it, write it as this, UII prime QI, so that this, in other words, if I wanted to think, let me write this in a matrix notation. So I'm going to call this a Q left Q right transpose. And then this delta is an identity matrix. So this is a matrix valued expression. Then it would transform, because of that transpose, it would transform as UQ left Q right conjugate transpose U. And so this vacuum expectation value goes to minus U squared delta. So that would give us a new vacuum, but it's just related by the SU2 axial symmetry. Because in the high energy theory, this vacuum, in terms of these quark degrees of freedom, the vacuum is just related by a symmetry transformation. It has to have the same energy. And in fact, for every matrix U, or for more precisely, for every U squared that I would get in this SU2, I'm going to get a different vacuum with the same energy. So each U in this SU2 axial will take me to a new vacuum that's degenerate in energy. And these, you know, these vacua form a manifold or moduli space, and that's just a fancy name for it. Okay, but now there's something cool. I can parametrize these as omega alpha is equal to e to the I times alpha A QA acting on the first vacuum that I chose, the one that had this identity expectation value. This QA, these QAs are just the integrals of the zero component of the current, right? This is just e to the I alpha A times an integral d cubed x JA zero eighth piece at x acting on my original vacuum. Now, let me just modify this operator a little bit. Let me define a state K alpha, which is equal to, instead of this, e to the I alpha A integral d cubed x. I'm just going to insert a little waviness to it. So I'm going to insert a phase, depends on x, with a wavelength k times ja 0a of x acting on omega. Okay? As k goes to 0, these states k alpha go to omega alpha, which was a vacuum state. So the energy of k alpha goes to 0. If I mean, goes to the energy of the vacuum, which I will henceforth call 0. Just starting my energy scale from there, as k goes to 0. That only happens for massless particles. Okay, so we've just defined, based on the fact, based only on the fact that there's a manifold of vacua omega, okay, that there's this whole family of omega alphas, there's some charge that moves me from one to another associated with spontaneously broken symmetry. If I have such a charge, I can always just add an e to the ikx factor and get a state that behaves like it has a wave in it, right? This is a state with that sort of a, where this k factor means that as a function of position, I'm wiggling from one vacuum to another. And that wiggle should be associated with the particle. Because the energy goes to 0, as the momentum goes to 0, we know it's associated with a massless particle. This is precisely the Goldstone theorem that guarantees this. Yeah. So let me see. So I should be able to write the one particle state, one way of creating the precisely the one particle state. I'm going to make this middle board disappear, if it's okay. One way of creating the middle particle, one way of creating the one particle state is just by and precisely guaranteeing that you have only one particle in it is, well, sorry, I can just write an integral d cubed x. Basically, just the exponent, something like the exponent of that in that exponential, a d cubed x e to the I k dot x j a 0 x acting on omega. And for a equals 1, 2, and 3, this is going to create a mass, a Goldstone boson. Which I'll call pi a. And formally, we can write that the expectation value, we now want to define a single particle state associated with pi a. So what we want to say is that if this operator creates a pi a, can also annihilate the pi a, then this, just because this J is a real object, it had better do both. Of J A 0 A of X. So I want to look at this expectation value. I want it to be not equal to 0, because this current is supposed to be creating particles. So that expectation value is going to be I times K mu, this is a J mu, some parameter F pi with mass dimension 1 times delta AB. Yeah. I'm sorry. I did not mean to write a 0 there. That's the point. Yeah. So we want to describe what the single pion state does when I mix it into a current, when I act with a current and then annihilate on the vacuum. And you can argue that it has to be proportional to K mu, it has to be proportional to K mu. That's just Lorentz transformation, right? What else can you write down? Delta AB, I want to contract these, I need to contract those two indices. And then just on dimensional grounds, pi field has dimension 1. Let's see. Am I actually going to do this right? The current J has naively dimension 3. Well, I'm actually going to come back to this for the dimensional argument. But indeed, this is precisely Goldstone's theorem. These pions are Goldstone bosons. What I want to emphasize is that everything we've done thus far, we're really not relying on this quark model of what the axial current is. Right? This is just constructed once we know that there is a spontaneously broken symmetry of the form, that JA, that there is some axial SU2 that's a spontaneously broken symmetry. It could be any symmetry. We can necessarily take one vacuum, use it to get to another vacuum, and then add waves to that kind of manipulation. Those waves have to correspond to states of one or more massless particles. So we can construct a single particle state. It's guaranteed to be massless. And there's one such massless state associated with each direction that you can spin the vacuum around, each direction in the SU2. So in this particular case, in general, these Goldstone bosons are always pseudoscalars. Okay, Goldstones are pseudoscalars. They're odd under parity. We can also ask how they transform under the other symmetries of our Lagrangian. How do they transform under the U1, and how do they transform under the SU2V? Under the U1, the pi's, so now this is specific to the case of an SU2 cross SU2 cross U1. The pi's are neutral under U1V because the JA is neutral under U1V. They're a triplet or adjoint representation under the SU2V. Again, because the current is a triplet under SU2V. And so these are properties that we know the pions have to satisfy. So now we can just ask, given these properties of the pions, given this pattern of SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 breaking, what kind of theory can possibly describe the effective theory of the pions? So, and these, remember, these are, in this limit, the pions are completely massless. So we know that we can go below the energy of all the other, you know, all the messy massless massive states. And at some low enough energy, well below that phase transition, we should have a theory describing only pions. There could be other light fermions too. Not going to consider that at first. But we know there aren't other funny quark bilinear states coming around, because there's no reason those would be massless. So what theory can describe these pions? Now, in the 7 or so minutes that we have, I want to try to find some candidate Lagrangians. So I want to find, and by the way, since these three pions, our three light degrees of freedom, are neutral under the U1 vector, in some sense, our low energy theory, you know, doesn't know about this symmetry or care about it anymore, right? A bunch of neutral things, they don't know whether there's a symmetry or not. So we want to find some candidate theories with the same symmetry. Pattern and the same symmetry breaking pattern of an SU2 vector cross SU2 axial going to just the SU2 vector with the axial part broken. To do this, it'll be convenient to embed the pions into some sort of master field that transforms the right way. Just as a way of simply keeping track of the transformations. So what I'm going to do, as one example, As one example is the linear sigma model. And I want to quickly talk about both this and the nonlinear sigma model, just very briefly. I'll work on them much more in the tutorial. So I'm going to define a field, sigma. My goal here is to build a theory, a simple theory that exhibits this symmetry breaking pattern with the same degrees of freedom at high energies as at low energies. Because it's a little bit cumbersome to work with the symmetry breaking pattern when in something like this, you know, confining QCD picture, the high energy degrees of freedom are quarks, the low energy degrees of freedom are pions. So we want to build a theory where we can see pions as low energy degrees of freedom and also pions as high energy degrees of freedom and just get some intuition for how that theory behaves. And it will be very helpful to us in constructing then the most general theory, most general low energy theory consistent with these symmetries, whose degrees of freedom are pions. Though we don't need to know, once we have that theory, the most general form, it's a matter of either calculating parameters by comparing to QCD, which for most parameters is very hard to do, or measuring parameters by looking at real world processes that include pions. Okay, but to know what parameters you have to measure, you have to construct the most general Lagrangian and see what the parameters are. So I'm going to start with a simple Lagrangian again. Field sigma, which I'm just going to define as, so this sigma is actually a matrix. It's sigma over 2 times the identity matrix, lowercase sigma, plus I times my tau A, pi A, where again tau A is defined as a sigma matrix divided by 2. Okay, so if you look at sigma dagger sigma, and you take its trace, well, you know that the trace of one tau matrix with any other tau matrix is going to be zero. The trace of a tau matrix with an identity is zero. So the only terms that show up are the sort of diagonal ones. That's just equal to, there's a term, goes like trace of sigma over 2 squared times the identity, plus terms that go like a sigma matrix squared, like pi a squared, times, you know, some sigma a squared over 4. That's also the identity, sigma a squared. You see why I'm doing this? Just because if you have a sigma a, sigma 1, sigma 2, or a sigma 1 times the identity, that's going to be traceless. So that's equal to 1 half sigma squared plus, you know, pi a, where I'm summing over that pion index, plus. And I'm going to define my sigma to transform under to a sigma prime, which is e to the minus I alpha a tau a sigma e to the I alpha a tau a under SU2 vector. I can call this V. Now this is equal to V sigma V dagger. Under SU2 axial, I'll just have sigma go to sigma prime, which is equal to V sigma V. Okay. Now, and again, invariance of a Lagrangian under these two is, of course, equivalent to invariance under a under separate SU2 lefts and SU2 rights, where the left multiplies sigma on the left, and the right multiplies sigma on the right. The linear sigma model is just the SU2 left cross SU2 right invariant Lagrangian for these guys. Okay. So what can I write that's dimensionally that up to dimension 4? That's the linear sigma model. So the Lagrangian for the linear sigma model, normalizable linear sigma model anyway, is going to have a term. So notice, how do I make invariance out of this? Well, trace of sigma sigma dagger would be invariant, right? Because I'd have a trace of sigma sigma dagger would go to trace of under, say, the vector v sigma v dagger sigma dagger v dagger, and these annihilate, and then since it's a trace, I can also cancel these guys against each other. So I can write down a kinetic term, trace of del mu sigma dagger del mu sigma. I can write down a mass squared term, trace of sigma dagger sigma. And I can write down a quartic term times trace sigma dagger sigma squared. If I weren't working in SU2,
so is it trace squared or is it sigma dagger sigma?
I'm going to say trace squared. But in SU2, it actually doesn't matter. In SU2, so I was about to say, in a more general theory, we'd write down another term, which just has sigma dagger sigma here. But in SU2, you can actually show that this trace is equal to that trace. When I have a 2x2 matrix sigma, obviously I could generalize this to an SU3 sigma model by making sigma a 3x3 matrix and putting in 8 pions and 8 lambda A's instead of the tau A's. Okay, but we're doing the SU2 sigma model. So this is it. And if you give this mass, and if you use m squared less than 0, sorry, m squared greater than 0, let me make these lambdas negative, just so that it corresponds to a positive quartic in the potential. And let me, sorry, I should really define it that way, so that the potential has a positive mass squared, positive lambda. Now, if m squared is less than 0 and lambda is greater than 0, I get an unstable potential at the origin of field space. And the vacuum needs to have non-zero sigma or some non-zero pi a's, really, and or some non-zero pi a's. I can choose to work in a vacuum where vev of sigma is not equal to 0, but the vev of all the pions is equal to 0, which respects SU2 vector. If I worked in a different vacuum, I mean, they should be equivalent. They are equivalent. If I worked in a different vacuum, it's not that, I mean, this particular SU2 vector would be broken, but there would be some other linear combination of the SU2s that's preserved. And the simplest way to do things is to just choose your basis for the, essentially choose your basis for the sigma in such a way that the sort of the canonical vacuum is the one that respects SU2V, and just work around that vacuum. Any other vacuum is physically equivalent, but then you'd want to define a slightly different, a rotated set of fields. And so this model has precisely the same symmetry breaking structure as the pions, except for that U1 vacuum, as our QCD pions, except for this U1 vector that I argued doesn't really play any role because the pions don't feel it. So this is the same symmetry structure as the pions. Now, there's no reason, this is the sort of canonical linear sigma model, there's no reason I can't add additional terms that have more depend on higher powers or have derivatives, say some 1 over m squared trace of sigma dagger sigma del mu sigma dagger del mu sigma, or trace of, so I'll call this C1, C2 over m squared trace of sigma dagger sigma cubed, and so on. It's easy for me to write down higher dimension operators. They're just longer chains of sigmas with more derivatives in them. Yeah? So are you asking why it respects, this vacuum respects SU2V? It's because under SU2V, I guess I'd say SU2V, SU2V takes sigma. Maybe this is the same thing you're saying, but in a different way, I'm not sure. It takes sigma to V dagger sigma, or sorry, did I write it the other way? V sigma V dagger. If sigma was just sigma times the identity, which is the case in the vacuum, that's the vacuum expectation value, then that takes it to V sigma times the identity V dagger, which is just equal to sigma times the identity because V is a unitary matrix. If I look at SU2 axial, where both of these are V's, and apply it to sigma times the identity, I would get sigma times V squared. which is not equal to sigma times the identity matrix. So it breaks SU2A. Now, let's see. Okay. Should I stop now or can I make one more point? I don't know when the next class actually starts. Okay, that's all I need. So in 1 minute, there's another parametrization that I just want to point out, one that we'll continue with next time. You'll actually look at another yet another parametrization of this field, capital sigma, in the tutorial. But I mean, I'm taking the same field theory, right? Same. I'm going to think about the same potential for sigma. I'm just going to decompose this sigma field in a different way, as being some v plus s times an exponential 2i tau a pi a over v. Okay. So this is just, again, just a different parametrization of how my fields pi are embedded into the field sigma. But it's clearly the same theory. The dynamics, it's the same, because this is a 2x2 matrix. I'm just picking components out of it in a different way. Compared to each other, if I call these pi primes, I can write expressions for pi prime in terms of the old pi's. I can write an expression for s in terms of the old pi's and the sigma. And they'll be nonlinear expressions. Pi prime a equals pi a, if I did my, at least if I chose my coefficients well, plus some things that go like pi a sigma a plus blah, 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 plus some pi b pi c, epsilon abc, et cetera. I can have lots of terms where these are going to be suppressed by 1 over v's for dimensional reasons. But this is basically the same theory described in terms of different degrees of freedom. This turns out to be a really convenient basis to use. The square root basis that you talk about in tutorial is also convenient for the same reason, because when I look at the action of SU2A on sigma and ask how does it affect the pion fields, in the linear parametrization, they would mix with sigma, even at the lowest order. And in this nonlinear parametrization, the pi's don't mix with sigma. At leading order, they just shift. OK, so I'm mentioning this. Be on the lookout for this fact when you're doing the square root representation problems in tutorial today. And think about what this shifting might have to do with any patterns you notice when you write down the low energy interactions in terms of pions. Yeah? Yes. Whereas in that parametrization, they mixed with sigma. Thank you. So that's just a comment. As you'll see when you work through this sigma model, so I started telling this story. Let me just finish it. Sigma, I can choose the vacuum where sigma gets a VEV and the pions don't, and then expand what's the action for the sigmas and the pi's. What you'll find is that, as we expect, because the pions are Goldstone bosons, the pions don't get a mass, and the sigma does. And so then you can imagine working even in a lower energy theory where you don't have the S around, just the pi's. That would really be the QCD-like theory. So we'll come back. These are the building blocks for the, you know, for writing the most general interaction of pions with one another. So we'll come back to that point tomorrow and pretty soon start adding masses as well.